All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucking ears? What the fucksters? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. I'm out of town. It's early in the morning for me, and I'm in a place where the sound bounces around, which you probably can't appreciate as much as I can. Appreciate not being the word that I really want to use. I mean, I'm not appreciating it. I guess that is the word. I'm acknowledging it. How's your morning going? I thought I was ready to do this, but I don't have much time. I have a small window of time here. Today on the show, Steve Sweeney, the veteran comic, one of the Mount Rushmore figures of Boston comedy. I knew him when I was starting out. He's here today. He's got a movie out. It's called Sweeney Killing Sweeney. It's available on iTunes and Amazon. When I was starting out in Boston, this guy was the king. He was one of the kings. There was like three or four kings, and Steve was one of them. So it was kind of interesting. I don't think I've really talked to him probably ever, but I talked to him a few times back when I was a kid, just a sprouting comic back at Nick's Comedy Stop in Boston. But I certainly haven't talked to him as an adult, and it was very interesting for me. It's like a trip back to a younger me. So let me explain what's going on here. Last time I talked to you, I was in St. Louis. And then on Sunday morning, I packed up my bags at 5 in the morning. I went to the St. Louis airport, and I flew to Toronto, Canada, Toronto, Ontario. And now I got here on Sunday afternoon, checked into a hotel, and went to a fitting for a movie. I got off the plane Sunday. I tried on a bunch of clothes from the 1970s, selected a few, and then I went and tried on a wig. And then that night I went and relaxed, and I looked at my work for the next day. I'm shooting this this David Bowie film with Johnny Flynn. And it's interesting about this movie has been out in the press a bit, and people's immediate response was like, no, don't ruin Bowie. Nah, you can't, you know. Look, I'm a pretty big fucking David Bowie fan. And I read this script, and I found it to be quite interesting. It's a very intimate movie. It's a very specific movie about a very specific time in Bowie's life. It's not some, you know, arcing biopic with a big scope. It really kind of takes place over like a 3-week period of time on a Bowie's trip to America in 1971. I play a music label Mercury publicist named Ron Oberman, who I don't really know anything about. He's still around, but apparently he's not really functioning that well, so I couldn't do that much research. But I see the lines, and I get it, and I'm just doing the work, man. Now I'm in it. It's the third day of shooting. We're shooting 12-hour days up here. But it's really the difference in shooting things, and I know this is kind of a new world for me, but when you're shooting can take a long time, but all these scenes are they're intimate, and there's only a couple of people involved so far. The crew is pretty small. There only seems to be one camera. The director shoots very quickly. The cinematographer, the DP, he's 80 years old, and his name's Nick Noland, and apparently he's been shooting stuff forever, and he actually shot John and Yoko in bed in a short documentary, and he shot some Mark Bolan footage back in the early 70s. I think my director, Gabriel Range, works with this guy a lot, or has worked with him before. But the idea that this guy shot these guys at that time is pretty trippy, man. And the fact that the dude is still working, I mean, schlepping cameras around, getting on the crane, getting into the little camera seat at 80 and just like, you know, killing it, which is a word I don't use that much, is pretty astounding. I wish I had time to talk to him, but this is going to be a cram, man. So the response to the Eve Ensler episode has been kind of overwhelming. And I'm getting a lot of feedback about the impact that episode had on people's lives, both men and women. And it's heavy, man. And I'm happy that happened. Thank you for the feedback, and I was happy to provide that service, really, which was to have that conversation with Eventsor and to share it with you guys. All right. I've got three pages of dialogue to do today. It's an outburst. I get mad at Johnny Flynn's David Bowie and have a little scene. I make a scene for the scene. And, you know, I mean, you folks know me. That's a stretch. So there's a lot of things going on that I don't have in front of me. You can go to WTFpod.com/tour to check out all the tour dates. There's been a couple added since I've maybe last talked to you. The Montreal Just for Laughs Festival. I'll also be up here in the Toronto Just for Laughs Festival. Glow is coming back on the air. Sword of Trust, which is S-W-O-R-D, Sword of Trust. The film I made with Lynn Shelton is opening, is premiering in theaters in July. And then as July kind of moves on, it's going to spread to a few theaters, about 24, 25 theaters. I believe that, I don't know if the dates for that are up on the website, but you can go to swordoftrust.com, I think, to get all the information on that. Oh my God, I think I need a break, you guys. I think I'm going to need a break. Is that okay if I take a break? Would somebody please give me a vacation? Mark, I'm talking to you. Mark, give yourself a vacation, will you? Can you? So, Steve Sweeney. How do I talk about Steve Sweeney? I oftentimes do not know how young Mark did what he did. I've no concept. I was in Los Angeles in the late 80s, got all fucked up on drugs, and went back to Boston to restart my comedy career that I'd started in Los Angeles at the Comedy Store. And, you know, that was 1988. And I some of you know this information, but I came in second in a big comedy contest there. And from, you know, that, like August 1988, I've been a working comedian since then. Long time. But there was a local comedy scene, it was really a regional comedy scene, that had this group of comics that just dominated it for years. And, you know, I was entering that world because I was living in Boston and it was a one-nighter market. And that's how that's how I made my bones, was running around to bars, discos, pubs, bowling alleys, hotel conference rooms of all different sorts, all over the New England area doing these gigs. And one of the big dudes at that time, there were a few of them, was Steve Sweeney. Steve Sweeney was like Boston's own comedic superhero, man. You just had this crew of people that a lot of people don't know because they were New England comics. I mean, they spread out sometimes. They took trips and they went to New York and they went to L.A. But, you know, and they did the evening at the Improv and this and that. But in terms of working comics, a lot of people didn't know, and there were dozens of them. And Steve Sweeney, was one of the big guys. He was if you were to go to New England and mention you, if you were to say to anybody in the Massachusetts, New Hampshire, Rhode Island region, you know a comic from Boston named Steve Sweeney, they would be like, of course I know Sweeney. He did these big characters, he owned them and he leaned into them and he just had a huge presence on stage. And I remember it wasn't a matter of intimidating. It was just that he was sort of mythic. I mean, you'd see him, you know, sometimes he'd do, you know, 10, 15 minutes when he's supposed to do 45, or he'd do 20. And then sometimes he'd do, an hour, but he was sort of always delivered the goods. But at the time back in the day, and this was, I think, before he sobered up, I don't know. He was intimidating. He was a little crazy. You know, he was kind of wild. So my memories of him are kind of like awe of some kind, and sort of like, you know, what's that guy about? You know, and just knowing that he was, you know, he was the guy. He's the king of fucking Boston, comedy wise. On that, you know, in that world. You know, I of course, like, entered the world of Catch a Rising Star, where it was me and Dave Cross and Janina Garofalo and Laura Keitlinger and Louie and Chuck Sklar and John Groff, Lauren Dombrowski, whatever. There was, we were then a generation beneath them, and we were in this little basement club in Cambridge, yet there was this regional scene, you know, this regional comedy community, and I worked within it, you know. I was there doing one-nighters with a lot of these guys, but it was intimidating in a weird way for me to talk to Steve Sweeney because, like I said, he held this place where I was like, if this guy was the biggest guy, and there was a couple of things that he did that I thought were just sort of astounding. And I really haven't seen or talked to him much, maybe in passing, but not really, in, you know, what, almost 30 years? But he came by, and I was excited for the opportunity. And he's created, made a new movie called Sweeney Killing Sweeney. It's available on iTunes and Amazon. And he'll be at the Improv Asylum in Boston this Sunday, June 23rd, doing his one-man show, Townie. And this is me talking to Steve Sweeney back in the house. Back in the house in California. Steve Sweeney and me. So, it's good to see you.
It's really good to see you, Mark. I watch you, and I watch Joe, and I watch other people. It's such an interesting thing to come back here to Los Angeles, because I lived here for 8 years.
Yeah.
And I remember having all of these, and then I came back out for a few auditions and stuff.
Yeah.
And when I didn't get them, I got flooded with those old feelings of like, why am I here? And just this terrible, terrible third world kind of 405 freeway kind of jumping out of my skin, loneliness and pain experience.
From when you lived here. From when you lived here.
But yeah, but see, when I come out and I actually have something, I feel like a valid human being. And then I come out to this place, I get to watch guys like you and Joe Rogan and Bill Burr and all this, you know. And I remember all of you guys.
when we were kids?
Well, I remember a lot of you freaking open for me. And I tell people, you want to get successful in this business, open for me. And then I'll get to watch you go by me.
Come on. It's not a race. It's not a race, Steve. It's a fucking crapshoot. This is like fucking standing at a roulette wheel. Yeah, when you got the talent, you hope that you fucking hit your number.
Well, let me put it to you another way, okay?
Yeah.
There's times in life when you fall into things, then there's times in life where you make conscious choices.
Sure.
So sometimes you make a conscious choice out of total...
desperation?
Yeah, desperation. So I left here. I was with a woman. I was engaged.
Yeah.
I like these podcasts because you can get personal, you know.
Sure.
I don't have to do shtick.
No.
And then I came back, and it was the one winter where it was like raining every day. It was like a tsunami.
Worst.
And I had a guy. I had one of those Oakwood apartments, you know, those corporate apartments.
Sure, the furnished ones.
The furnished ones.
Yeah.
And so the guy next to me, you could hear through the wall. He had to call Africa every day at 3 because that's when they wake up. And I like that he spoke from his heart. But I was getting homicidal, you know. No, this is an important call. I have to make this call. It's my family. And then I was just overwhelmed with this tremendous sense of isolation. And what I said was, I don't know where I have to go, but I got to get the fuck out of here.
But let's go back, though, because like when I was in Boston, like I came in second in that riot in 88. 1988.
Oh, that was Chicago, the riots.
No, that was an earlier riot. This was the WBCN riot. So right, I lost to, I was in sec. I lost to Sue McGinnis.
Oh, yeah.
You remember her?
Yeah.
How's she doing? Do you see her around? She's still doing it?
I guess.
All right.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, she's probably doing it. Yeah.
So I started working then, you know, around Boston, doing the one-nighters, working, you know, opening, driving you guys around to different parts
That's
of the
right.
world. I remember driving Dick Dougherty somewhere. Dick Dougherty. He goes, you know what your problem? You're insecure. You're insecure. But like, that's when I started doing the thing. When I started working for a living was 88. And that's when I first started meeting you guys.
Yeah.
And your crew was you and Gavin, George McDonald.
Lenny
Clark.
Kenny Rogerson.
Kenny Rogerson.
Yeah.
Was it Warren McDonald, Mike McDonald, Sisler, Lazarus. You know, like
that's funny.
They're all around.
You know, everybody was around. Leary before he got big. So you guys were like, you know, you were the big guys in the Boston area. And the weird thing about Boston, I don't think that people know, but I've talked to a few guys on the show, is that it was its own thing. It's always been its own thing.
Absolutely.
There are guys that, you know, have made a living, a good living for years. Joe Iannetti started with me.
Yeah.
For years, right? And, you know, and it was its own, you know, you could work every weekend somewhere.
Yeah.
But you were like, it was like, I just remember the first time seeing you, it must have been at like fucking Knicks.
Yeah.
And then I started doing shows there.
Yeah.
And it was a scary place, Steve, for an aggravated, sensitive Jew like myself. It's amazing I lived through it.
It was a scary place for me.
I know.
We are not on camera, but this is a great joke.
Yeah.
So I want you to ask me.
Yeah.
Was Nick's a mafia joint? Ask me that.
Was Nick's a mafia joint?
Oh, yeah. So what I just did was I said no and yes with a head shake.
Well, I mean, I remember those guys. I just remember there were, like, you know, here's what I'm thinking. Like, here's the fucked up thing about, like, you know, you're coming over and I'm like, in my mind, I'm like, what happened to Trigger?
Trigger Burke. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Trigger is no longer with us. But yeah. I got to tell you something. You know, it's so funny. Where I grew up.
Yeah.
I grew up with guys.
Which town?
Charlestown.
Yeah.
They made a movie of it called Town. But I grew up with professional criminals.
Right.
Okay?
Yeah.
And a rite of passage was shoplifting.
Right.
Okay?
Yeah.
Which I was so bad at. I mean, I was just, like, the worst. But
yeah.
Trigger, who was a petty thief, he'd done some time, whatever, but he was around the scene. I'll never forget this. 400 people at Nick's. I'm doing great. I'm on the stage.
Right.
The waitress, of course, they got no clue. They bring me a note. Yeah. I figure somebody's car is being towed or somebody had a heart attack.
Yeah.
Trigger Burke had sent me this note. Toaster ovens, $20. He was selling hot frickin' ovens.
In the parking lot?
So I grew up with this one guy, and I was like, I was in these cars, and we ended up in this sort of armed robbery, blah blah blah, but anyway, that part of it's not interesting.
Oh, okay.
But this part of it is. So I do Nick's, and I look out in the audience, and there's this guy from Charlestown, Joe Rocco. I'm gonna use his name because he's no longer with us. And I got 400 people. It's practically a standing ovation.
Yeah.
So I see him afterwards. He comes up to me. And I said, I was expecting him to say, Jesus, great you got out of Charleston.
Yeah.
Or I liked the show or I didn't like the show. But something to do with the event.
Right.
So this is exactly what he said to me, Mark. And he had that look in his eye. He says, it's got to be a lot of money in here. I said, you came here so that I could case the joint from the frickin' stage. Jesus Christ. But this is the comedy, just, you know, I guess the word is organic, because get all these guys in the street corner, you know, they're funny, and that, why don't we try this? But when I started, there was no comedy clubs.
But like, what, let me ask you,
I was
you
opening
something
for, you know, BB King and Sugar Shack and all
but,
this
but
stuff.
But who was like at that time, like in Charlestown, like how many kids in your family? Like what was
I'm the youngest of five.
Of five. So and that's, it's not Southie, it's Charlestown.
You better fucking believe it. Don't ever make that mistake. There's the North End and there's Charlestown.
Right.
You go over the bridge
Charlestown. Yeah. Now, so like you're a little older than me. Like what was the neighborhood like? I mean,
it was unbelievable. But it
in
but
a good
it's,
way?
But it's normal. I thought it was unbelievable in a great way, but there was a mix of people that things were normal. In my one-man show, which I call Townie, I talk about these events that happened to me in my life that were like, and people, you know, like Vietnam, for example. So I went to see a psychiatrist because I got drafted and everything, and I said, okay, so you know, like when you see someone get shot, and they fall down and the blood's coming out. Or you know how like when you have an armed robbery and everybody leaves and no one says that? And the psychiatrist said to me, no, that's totally outside my experience. Do you think everybody does? I said, isn't that normal? So it was this wonderful mix. Everybody knew each other. It was like Charlestown was all Irish. The North End was all Italian. And I will never forget this. One of the most important things in Charlestown was... You didn't have to win, but you had a fight. You didn't have to win, but you had to fight. Now, there were individual fights.
Yeah.
And I'll never forget Davey Latta and the Projects. He broke one of the rules. These were fist fights, yeah. Mark. He kicked me in the balls, and it was like, you know, it was like Pavarotti hitting the high notes.
Sure.
So then everybody jumped in, they got him. So those were the individual fights. But then there were town fights, the Irish guys against the Italians. So we were lined up on the bridge, so you'd be lined up against one guy. But I feel like you like movies, I assume.
Sure.
I felt like I was watching a movie because it, being Irish, we don't have any feelings. Everything's suppressed. Even the way we dance is like everything's stiff. And this guy's across from me. And it's like an operation. I'm going to take your fucking ear. I'm going to tear that off. You're going to have to fucking swallow that. Then I'm going to take your fucking up. And so I'm an actor. So when you're an actor, there's always you and then you watching you. And then you watching the scene, I said, this is fucking great.
Yeah.
This guy's amazing. I forget I'm supposed to be fighting him.
Yeah.
So it was all, it was, you know, homogeneous. Is that the word?
Sure.
Did you grow up in a mixed neighborhood?
Not really. I mean, where I grew up in New Mexico, Albuquerque, it was about, when I was growing up, it was about 60 or 70% Latino. But it wasn't really mixed in the same way the East Coast places are mixed. Like my high school was mostly... You know, it's a large Latino community.
But you're Jewish.
I'm Jewish, yeah. We came by way of Jersey
Albuquerque. How do you spell your last name?
Maron. It's not. I just did that Finding Your Roots show. It's not a Jewish last name, and it wasn't changed. But I'm a Jew all the way back, 100%. DNA test came back, Jew. Ashkenazi Jew.
I can see you in New Mexico with the, you know, the Latinos. Hey, it's like Jackie Mason. I want to tell you the truth.
Sure, right.
Hey, Pueblos, hey, come on. We're going to go up to the Pueblos. Come on.
That was a little like that.
What about American Indians? Were those guys?
They were around, yeah. They were around.
Are you a spiritual person?
Somewhat. I don't know if I am. I probably, not actively. Are you?
Yes, very much so.
Like, what do you do? Are you still Catholic?
Only for funerals.
Yeah.
You know, you have to be respectful.
Sure, of course.
But I have practices, but I'm also interested in that part of the world for the Native American kind of thing, the Pueblo culture and all of that.
You can go see all that stuff.
D.H. Lawrence wrote a book about...
Yeah. He lived in New Mexico.
Yeah, and he said, you know what? This place, and of course he was English.
Yeah.
He said, this place does not fit... human beings, he said, there's something off about this because he was from a European culture, which is indoors.
Oh, he wrote that when he was in New Mexico?
Yeah, he said, it's, you know, Europeans are more indoors and everything.
No space.
Anyway, I have a fascination with those open places. What I do is every summer...
Dennis Hopper did a lot of coke at that D.H. Lawrence place back in the
day. Did he?
I think he lived up there for a while. Yeah, you have a theory?
I love Dennis Hopper.
Greatest. Great.
I love him. He had a look, you know, when he was in like Apocalypse Now. This man's unbelievable. I'm telling you, you want to see this guy.
He's going to go out and land on a fraction.
Yeah, but then how about in Blue Velvet?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. Don't look at me. Don't look at me. And then with Stockwell there, who I later met.
Yeah.
When he played Roy Orbison.
Yeah, yeah. Candy colored clown,
they call the clown man. Whispers in his arms, and then with each between each bar, they were kicking the guy.
Yeah.
But there was something about him that I just found lovable. And then I'm really not going to get too personal about this, but in Hoosiers when he played the alcoholic father, do you remember that movie?
I love it.
He was so vulnerable. He was beautiful. But I saw him in New York. He was directing. He was a multifaceted guy.
Did a few movies. His movie, Out of the Blue, was one of the most devastating, fucked up movies I've ever seen.
I've never seen that.
But you're talking about open spaces.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I do. I'm sober 26 years, coming up on 27.
All the way through?
Well, Sundays. <man. laughs> No, we also give chips, you know, at AA.
Yeah.
And I always say... With salsa? But anyway, we're not going to go there.
We can go there. I'm almost 20.
Wow, that's great.
I'm fairly open about it on the air because I think it helps people. Tradition be damned. But that's my trip.
Yeah, no, that's fine. So in the program, they say, find a God of your understanding. So what I wanted to do, Mark, was I didn't want to just say, okay, here's what I want in a God, like a freaking casting session.
Yeah.
You know, I said, well, if I'm going to find this, I have to experience it. Mm. It's like Carl Jung on his deathbed. They said, do you believe in God? And he said, no, I know God. So what I did was I just went out to Zion National Park Bryce Canyon and
Utah?
All of that. Yeah, and Red Rock Canyon outside of Vegas. And that's where I experienced the higher power.
The white light moment?
Yeah, a lot of them.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, what happened for me was I lost the obsession.
Right.
Which was very freaking painful.
Took a while, right? A few years it took for me to really not think
about
it.
I got it at once because I bounced for 10 years and then I just prayed. I didn't know what I was praying to and that left. Then, of course, the obsession went right to the woman who had just left me. And that fucking thing lasted forever. And I took courses in what they call mind-stopping.
Mind-stopping?
Yeah.
What's that?
You picture a white card and you just every time you get caught up in it but the way to
the obsession
because it's an obsessive compulsive personality disorder.
Believe me, I'm living in it.
Are you really?
Every day. Sure. Yeah, mine manifests in I either go to dread and sort of get into a paralysis or I get anxiety where you know I have to do a bunch of little things here and there, and I'm eating these nicotine lozenges, I'm drinking tea all day. You know, it comes up in different places, but, you know, as long as it's not making my life unmanageable.
I can help you.
With the white card?
No. Would you like me to help you?
Right now?
Yes.
Are you going to tell me something, or are you going to hit me? You've got to smack me upside the head.
You've got to be open to this. Are you open to this?
Okay.
So I work in jails. I work at the Plymouth County Jail, and I worked at Dedham, and I work with kids.
Yeah.
So this is something that was taught to me. There's two things you got to. This is for your mind,
okay?
Which is the future's anxiety, the past is depression.
Yeah.
Where are my feet?
Yeah, right here.
That's it.
Yeah.
So you keep coming back to the same moment. But what really worked for me with all of this was to practice a breathing exercise: breathing in 4, breathing out 4.
Mm.
Now you're like me; you're all up in your fucking head.
Right.
I know you're not going to do it. No, you won't. I know you. You're bullshit me. But I'm telling you, when you're in some airport, which I've just been through for flights and the San Diego freeway, I just practice breathing deeply, and the mind listens to the breath, so it helps me.
Do you meditate as well?
Yeah, I practice what they call mindfulness.
Right.
Which meditation's got all
the breathing and the
I sit there.
Yeah.
I start with these breathing techniques and I feel like Russell Brand now giving my bullshit out here, but anyway.
No, it is helpful. What do you do in jails?
I teach what I've just told you. I teach guys to how to be in the moment, and my official title is substance abuse counselor.
Oh, so did you have to log some hours and get a little certificate?
I have a master's in psychology in counseling.
See, I used to hear this about you. Like, you know, you were this mythical character that I'd hear about occasionally. Because, I remember, seriously, and we can get back to, the evolution. But, like, one of the last memories I have, like, I remember when you were in trouble. Like, you were in trouble. Like, one of the last conscious memories I have, and maybe I've seen you once or twice since then, was back in the 80s at Nick's. And I don't know, you had lost your mind.
Yeah.
And, you were in the back room and you were
sad.
And you were bloody. I don't think there was anyone else involved. I don't remember what happened.
Oh my God!
but I just remember that Dominic was there.
Oh
maybe
yeah,
Jackie was there. No. Credico was there.
There's a thing that I would like to introduce you to that if you don't know, it's called cocaine induced psychosis.
I had it.
Well, let me do the dialogue.
Okay.
Did you hear that?
No.
Did you hear that?
I didn't hear it.
Did you hear that?
No.
You had to hear that. That's cocaine-induced psychosis.
My problem when I had it was
the whole conversation.
Do you hear the voices? I hear the voices.
Yeah.
Do you hear them?
You hear them? No.
Yeah.
And then the guy gets pissed off. You tell me you didn't fucking hear that. I was with a Vietnam vet who said that. I said, listen, I got to go home. Why are you leaving? Well, we've been sitting here for 12 hours sweating, looking at each other. I think it's appropriate to leave. Isn't it amazing we lived through it?
It's fucking amazing,
man. It's a gift.
So from Charlestown to acting, I mean, how do you make the decision to, get off the bridge and pursue
my
the dream?
My brother was 19. I was 19. My brother called me up. He's at Smith College. He says, do you want a job for the summer? And I said, I don't know. I guess so.
Yeah.
And he said, what is it? He said, acting. So I said, Jimmy, you know I'm not gay. Why do you ask me that? Because everybody who I knew in Charleston, that was gay.
An actor
but,
was
but
gay?
It was Smith College.
Yeah.
And I went up there, and it was all girls. I loved it.
Yeah.
But I got to tell you, you've done some acting.
But yeah, but you weren't in the acting program? You were just...
No. I was nothing.
Yeah.
But you've done some acting.
Yeah.
So when you first start and you feel an emotion, you really think you're good.
Yeah, right.
You know?
Yeah, I'm still in that phase.
But I was doing Shakespeare.
Right.
And I had that horrible Boston accent.
Right.
But I was a big, tall guy, so I was Macbeth. And I was like, is that a dagger that I see before me? And you think you're being great, you know, or, you know, Richard III.
Yeah.
A hoss.
Come on.
You know what it's like? It's
but
like,
where were you doing this?
But that was at Smith. But
like you weren't in the college? It was just a job?
It was a summer theater.
Okay, I get it.
And then I went back to UMass and I studied it. But have you ever sat through some of these college productions?
Not lately.
Well, it's fucking awful. And... But the other kids, they were all from New York, and they had accents, too. You know, I want to tell you the truth. There's been a, hey, Macbeth, there's been a murder, the horror.
Really?
But then I got the bug, and I love theater. I still love it to this day. And I was a doorman at the theater.
Where?
As a stagehand at the Schubert, the Colonial. And it's now the Wang Center. And I saw all these amazing actors.
Like who?
Well, I saw him. He wasn't performing.
Yeah.
But Joan Plowright was doing a play, and she was married to Laurence Olivier.
No, yeah.
So Laurence Olivier came in, and I swear to God.
Yeah.
He went in, you're not going to believe this.
I'll believe it.
But he went in the sub shop to buy a sub. I said, Laurence Olivier is ordering a freaking sub.
Yeah.
So my mind is
guy's got to eat.
Guy's got to eat. Yeah. But I'm saying to myself, he's saying, I love a pepper and cheese and with the onions.
Is that for here or to go?
But I'll tell you who I saw, and I was later did a movie with him was Christopher Plummer.
Yeah,
saw Richard Burton do Equus, Jack Lemmon.
Oh.
You know, it was wonderful. It was amazing.
And you were you were a kid, like 20?
Yeah, early 20s. Yeah.
So
I fell. I did a one man show, and I fell into stand up because I did a one man show of all these characters, and then I was broke, and the guy said, "Why don't you go up there as yourself?" The first year, I didn't even use a mic.
Yeah. You could get big, man.
Yeah, but I was just, I fell into it, man. I fell into it. And I said this to Joe. I said, I got into stand-up to get acting work. And I'm still fucking waiting.
You've been in a few things.
Yeah, no, I've been on a lot of movies. And I just produced my first movie, Sweeney Killing Sweeney. And listen to this cast, Stephen Wright, Bobby Slayton, Frank Santarelli,
Tony DiPaolo.
Nick DiPaolo.
Jonathan Katz, saw in the trailer.
John Katz. How brilliant is he? He's got a great line in the movie. He said, you know, my uncle, who was a well-known judge, and even when he was down and out, and he was a bum in the Bowery, people still said to him, may I approach the bench? How great a line is that?
Yeah. No, the movie, it looks good and it looks fitting. Like, I completely get the premise.
Yeah.
Because, like, you were and are the character guy. But it's interesting just the arc of it. So you're doing a one-man show, and who approaches you? There's no stand-up at that time. There's no clubs yet. Is that what you're telling me?
No. They started... there were no comedy clubs. I did the one-man show at the Charles Playhouse.
Oh, yeah.
And then they said...
That became the Comedy Connection, right? Or Next
said,
Door?
You know, I was just doing this crazy shit. Then I did it at the Ding Ho, and I was exploring, and that was, you know...
So the Ding Ho was around?
That started, like, years later. But I was still doing these fucking crazy characters.
Right.
Like, my heroes were, like, Lily Tomlin, Jonathan Winters, that stuff.
There was a precedent. Yeah. For doing that type of comedy?
To me, since then, nobody touches Carlin, Pryor, Lily Tomlin, Jonathan Winters for me.
Yeah, you
know?
Sure.
No one's touched them.
So you're doing this stuff, and when do you start working as comedy? Like, because I'm sort of fascinated with that whole thing, you know, because I got there a little late. You know, the first time I started doing comedy there was in college in 84. So I was doing...
Where'd you go to college?
Boston University.
Wow.
Yeah. So I was doing, the first time I tried stand-up, I was doing open mics at Plating and Sam's.
Yeah.
Right? Stitches. the original one.
Yeah.
What happened to Harry?
Harry?
Yeah. Harry Conforti.
I think he's still probably working for Pat Lyons.
Okay.
Yeah.
I remember Harry, you know.
He's a good guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, but it was like...
He could work at Ace Hardware, Harry.
Yeah, he could work anywhere.
You know, he had that kind of, hey, what's going on?
Yeah,
you
know.
Yeah,
you know,
he goes through... Guys like that go through life. They don't go through life like us.
No, no. They find a gig. They enjoy life. They seem like the kind of people...
Everything bounces off them. Yeah, their whole attitude is like, whatever.
Yeah. I can't... I envy it, but then some days I'm grateful. So that's 84, but when the Ding Ho was... I went to open mics at the Ding Ho.
Yeah. That was Lenny's night, Wednesday nights. My night was Sunday nights.
Lenny's night. That's right. I always had these issues with, like, you know, where Kenny Rogerson used to have the open mic it played against Sam's.
Yeah.
And you put your name on a fucking list and he gets shit faced in the middle of the show.
Mm-hmm.
And there was like a couple of times where like he just forgot to put me on and I stayed there all night. But when you're an open micer, half of you is hoping you don't go on. But I just used to watch and watch and the names would go by and names would go by and then he'd close the show and I'd be like, what the fuck? And
here's how I look at it.
Yeah.
All of those humiliating, debilitating, awful experiences create who you are.
Yeah.
Like for me, I remember this guy said to me, and you know, I was making a living and everything, and he said to me, why are you bitter? And I said, wow, this is a choice I make.
Yeah.
You know, but I can remember being humiliated doing this job. There was one incident played at Ground Round, me and Jay Charbonneau, and the guy was throwing ice.
Jay Charbonneau?
He's great.
Yeah.
But he, the guy was throwing ice at him on the stage.
And he was always, you could always count on Jay for a snap. He'll snap, man.
Yeah.
And that would happen.
Yeah. So, but he did his thing.
Yeah.
Then my opening line, Mark, right? Now, can you imagine this?
You
go to a fucking comedy show and the comedian's
at
opening.
At the Ground Round.
The opening line of the comedian was this. I said, any motherfucker that throws a fucking piece of ice at me, I'm fucking going right over. Now, let's have fun. I mean, it's like, forget about
you
it.
You had to, but that was the nature of the one-nighter.
But I feel like it's humiliating, it's debilitating, but it builds you up.
Oh, no
so
shit.
That now, I don't take any shit. If they're texting, turn it off. I'm not going to be clever. I got one line for it. I said, look, you're putting us out of a job. Because the comedian of the future... I'll text you a joke. You text back, LOL. That's the end of it.
Yeah.
But I had one woman in the audience, and she looked at me in this kind of superior way. Well, I can multitask. I said, oh, good. So when I stick it up your ass, you're still going to be, you know.
Good one.
But then when I came out here the last time, and I was on Joe over there at the improv, the audience was fantastic. I said, oh, my God, they're here to actually see comedy.
Yeah.
I can see why people like it out here.
Yeah, you know? There's good nights now. You know, the clubs are like kind of popping again.
You know,
and Joe pulls people in. You know, the Comedy Store is great. You know, it's always packed. But
is that where you work?
I do primarily the Comedy Store when I'm in town.
Yeah.
I like it. Yeah, it's like I had a lot of experiences there. I feel like I belong there. It feels.
I
like
had a lot of experiences there. Believe me.
I'm sure I had similar experiences
with Sam Kennison.
I had them too. The same experience
with Sam.
With Sam, but later probably.
Oh, my God. We were up at Joni. He bought a house from Joni Mitchell.
The one in Malibu?
This was up on a hill, and I'm up
What year
there.
Was this?
I lose track of the years, but we're all up there, and we're in this little room, you know, with all the stuff.
The stuff, yeah.
And I said, I could be in fucking Somerville in an alley. You know, this is like...
It was crazy.
Boy, Sam, ooh, Jesus Christ. Yeah. I spent a lot of hours with him.
Me
Jesus
too.
Christ.
Yeah, okay. Ooh. Look me in the eye, Sweeney. I can't trust a man doesn't look me in the eye.
He had that thing. Yeah,
yeah.
I was like, fuck. I thought I was bad. You know what I mean? I was like, what am I doing in this room?
I was a one-on-one, man. 3 days.
You were?
Yeah, well, sure, man. I mean, like, I lived in that fucking house up behind the Comedy Store later. You know, I was there in 87. So you must be talking about, like, early before he broke, right? Or was it?
No, this was after he broke. And he was big, but he...
Oh, maybe it was later.
But he was brilliant.
When were you out here?
You know what, Mark? You keep asking me years.
Oh, I'm sorry. But
that's
like,
okay.
But it was, I'm just but trying to figure out, was it before or after?
You understand that I don't remember a day of the 90s.
I get it. But I was here when Lenny was here. Like, I was here when Lenny was in that crew.
Yeah, it was like, Lenny, Carl LeBeau, Sam Kennison.
Right, right. Yeah. So he was running with them, but you weren't around. So you were already back home or you hadn't come yet.
But he would bring himself Sam.
Yeah, would bring.
And then I did the movie with him, Back to School.
Right.
Yeah.
So and that
then,
was
then
me.
He had another wonderful opportunity. He was like, but the best comedian I ever saw and ever will see was Richard Pryor.
Right. At the Comedy Store?
Yeah, I saw him every day, but I also saw his movies, and he was thrilling. But George Carlin,
oh yeah,
those guys, you know.
Sure.
So
the Ding Ho, Sunday nights.
Yeah,
that was your night.
I just did characters. That's all. I just got up and did characters.
But people don't realize that this was a Chinese restaurant that had a showroom.
Yep.
Jimmy Tingle was the bartender.
Yep.
Before he became a comedian.
Yeah.
Mark Clark was the doorman.
Mark, that's right. Mike booked it.
Mike Clark booked
it. But Barry Crimmins started the whole thing.
Right, on the Wednesdays. Him and Lenny.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then you would host guys. It wasn't an open mic yours. You'd have you and you'd do like...
No, yeah. I did all characters. It was just me.
So you'd just do it for an hour, hour and a half?
Oh, yeah.
When does the sort of career really in Boston take off? When does Nick's happen?
I did HBO Young Comedians with John Candy.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's right. That was like, I'm going to tell you right now if you want to date, 83.
All right, so I did that.
Yeah.
And then I was on Letterman.
Yeah.
And then I...
I remember seeing you on Letterman.
Yeah, so I did
a couple times. Or just how many times did you do that?
Just once.
Yeah.
Or as Kenny Rogers would say, I did it when it was in black and white. So then I did that.
Kenny was so
fucking
funny. How's he doing?
Kenny's doing great.
Oh, good.
And he's, of course, condemned. You know what the moving prisons are, don't you?
No.
They're called cruise ships.
Oh.
That fucking life. Jesus.
Him and Christ. Gavin. Doesn't Gavin live on a dock?
Oh, my God.
Does he live in Portland or something?
No, he lives in Boston. Oh. But, oh, my God. This is a weird subject to talk about, but I think I can talk about it with you safely.
Yeah. Okay.
The isolation of that kind of a life is just, if you are drinking, you're all set.
Yeah, if you are.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure. You're not going to run into anything.
If you're not drinking, oh my God, this is a floating bar room.
There's that too, but you and I seem similar in that, you know, that the what you were explaining when you were out here, you know, living in those apartments and not working, that like I can feel very isolated among people. Like even if it doesn't matter where I am, if I get that loneliness now, like I'm not part of it.
Yeah.
That, and it's just paralyzing and dark. It can get very horrible very quickly. And the idea of being on a boat, not only not drinking, my biggest concern is, what if you have a shit show? You got to walk up and down the fucking boat, and those people that you perform for, they're going to be there for the whole 3 or 4 days that you're on the boat.
You're captive of the audience.
You can't get away.
No. Don Gavin does a great thing at the end of his act. He says, listen, if you see me on the ship and I'm reading or whatever, don't come up and say hi to me.
Yeah.
And they all think it's a joke. Yeah. And then they'll come up to him and say, he'll say, didn't I tell you? Don't bother me. you're stuck with the audience. It's just my life has changed because...
Wait, we're back in 1983. So you do Letterman.
All right.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Then you do the Young Comedians and you do Letterman. And then there was that moment. This is sort of the question I have. It's like...
Yeah.
Where, you know, there's something about Boston where, you know, you're taken care of, you know, Mike Clark's working you, you got yeah, the, you know, sure, you're in it next, sure. they're taking care of you. And that, you know, that's scary and good when Nick's is taking care of you. But there was a time there where, you know, all those like Mike and everybody, there was a lot of work and Nick's was opening rooms everywhere.
Yeah.
But you wanted to make a go of it. So you came to New York. I remember you going down to New York and trying to cut in.
I was in New York and I was in L.A. I was in the New York Laugh Off, and I came in fifth, fourth. What a fucking humiliating experience that was.
Yeah,
you know, you're standing on the stage, and Joe Bolster.
Oh yeah,
but you're standing on stage, and then they announce the other three, and you got to go up and pretend you're happy.
I know, it's fucking.
I remember. I auditioned for Ed McMahon's show. Do you remember that
Star Search?
And I said, here I am, auditioning for something I don't want, and I'm being rejected.
that's the fucking thing about show business. You're so, you know, you feel like you should go for everything, or you got that desperation of like, I got to make a break, and then you're doing shit like it's just terrible. There's actually, I did things on camera where I'm like, why the fuck did I do that? They didn't even need a funny guy.
Yeah.
But okay, so you decided to move to LA to make a go of it, right?
Yeah. Well, I had been out here earlier because I went to USC for graduate school.
For what, 2 years?
That was three. And then I came.
In acting?
No, I got my master's in writing.
Really?
Yeah, MFA.
You went to a lot of colleges.
Yeah,
so I liked school. But you were, this was after you did comedy or before?
Before, yeah. So when I was going to USC, I loved it. I was living in Venice.
Yeah.
I was so poor, I was taking buses. Who the fuck takes buses out here?
I know. I don't know how long it takes. I don't know how long it takes. I can only assume it takes.
I was, you know, I got a friend of mine, Jimmy Labriola. He's always wanting to go 1 foot in and 1 foot out.
I know that guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so he wanted to be a bus driver. You know, you always thinking, too, there's got to be another job.
I wanted to be a grill guy, cook. I just wanted to flip eggs.
So the bus drivers out here, I was so fascinated. How many routes do you do a day? And they only do a few because the streets are so long. And, you know, I went back and I'd say to the bus drivers back in Boston, how many do you do? Oh, 20. I fucking hate it, you know?
fucking hate it.
So anyway,
I took a bus to my first evening in the Improv at down there in Santa Monica.
I did five of those evenings at the Improv
in the late '80s, right? At the one in Westwood, right?
Yeah,
or wherever it was, Santa Monica.
They had great hosts for those things.
Sure, they had everybody.
Yeah, that was cool. Bud was always good to me.
Yeah, I saw him the other night.
Did you did?
Yeah, his daughter had a benefit for a school at the Improv, and he was there. I think he might have had a little stroke or something. He's good.
How old is Bud now?
I don't know. He's got to be almost 80, if not more.
He was always very nice to me.
Well, that's good.
When I was out here, there was like a thing. You don't work, you work the Improv or you work the other place. You can't work both.
Well, I couldn't work either. I was a doorman at the store in 87.
You were?
That's when I got in trouble with Sam, for about a year.
Did you work with that fighter out there? Remember there was
Vinny Curto. No, he came after. I was in and out within a year. I was fucked up with cocaine psychosis. I went back to Boston, and that's when I met you guys.
You could feel it in the comedy store when you walked in. You could feel it, the darkness.
Oh, dude, it's gone, though. A lot of that was in my head. It took years to shake it, because when you have cocaine psychosis, everything means a lot more than it really does.
Oh, it's unbelievable.
Oh, it's all loaded, man.
And how about...
Never good.
How about when somebody... Yeah, there's this... incredible need to say something, even though there's absolutely nothing to say.
Oh, yeah, and you're interrupting people to say it. It's to say nothing.
but there's that moment where I timed it one night. A guy said goodnight, and he didn't leave until another hour. No, I'm leaving. Okay, guys, I'm leaving. Okay, really, I'm leaving. Okay.
I used to watch those dudes, man.
Because you're afraid to be alone. You're afraid to be together, you know.
Lenny's good and sober now, too, right?
23 years, yeah.
Oh, my God, do I remember you guys, man. I remember you guys. Yeah. He could go, man.
He could go.
Oof. Yeah.
I mean, I guess that's part of it. I mean, if you look at a lot of great artists, people used to say to me, all the comedians, are you all just always screwed up? I said, only the good ones, really.
Yeah.
Because if somebody was really looking for a job, you know, with short-range, mid-range, long-range goals.
Yeah.
This is not the job.
There's a whole new generation that seem a lot more socially adept than we were, I'll tell you that. The guys,
really?
Yeah, the people that come up and sketch and, you know, working with other people.
With other human beings.
Yeah. I mean, it's a whole different thing. But, you know, the old school guys, a lot of us are a mess.
You know, I went back to the Improv the last time I was out here, and I hadn't been there in years.
Yeah.
And I expected people to look at me, what's this old fart doing here and everything? And people were so respectful.
Oh, yeah.
It was nice. Oh, and they knew me.
Yeah.
Which was like, I always feel like I'm just this regional guy. But, you know, I've done a lot of stuff. And, I mean, you know, when you look at your past, sometimes I saw Bill Murray in a great interview. Have you interviewed him, too?
No, I'd like to. He's one of the guys that's like a white whale. I can't get him.
Charlie Rose, who we don't even have to get into where he is now, you know, but he said to Bill Murray, you did all this stuff. And Bill Murray said, I wish I was there for it.
Yeah.
And I knew exactly what he was saying. He wasn't in the moment. He wasn't enjoying it.
Yeah, I'm trying to do that now. Because you want to keep, I don't know what it is. You know, it's just, you don't appreciate the process.
Right.
And you don't even know exactly what your goal is, but it ain't what you're doing. Necessarily.
But maybe that's the problem we have, is the idea of a goal. In other words, it's like the journey is the destination. You know, so yeah. Where are my feet? That's what I say all day. Where are my feet?
My ex-wife from years ago who got me sober, she used to do that trick with me. When I was first getting sober, she had a few years.
Yeah.
And she'd go like, you know, when I'd be spinning, she'd go, what color are your shoes?
Wow.
Yeah, where are we?
Where are
What's
we?
On the wall?
That wow, that's good, huh?
Yeah, the same idea. Yeah. So you so when you go out to L.A. the second time, yeah. How long were you out here? Were you going on auditions?
I was doing the whole thing. I got what they call a holding deal.
Sure.
From Carsey Warner Productions. They paid me not to do anything, and it was amazing. It was
like one of those good ones, couple hundred grand?
No, it was like 50 grand.
That's
but
good.
It was like, this is fantastic. It's like a city job you're paid to just
And you're doing sets do at the store?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Both. Then that ended, and I don't know what happened. I just decided I didn't want to be here. I felt when you grow up in a close-knit community yeah. like Charlestown, you get used to that.
Yeah.
And that's where my people, my family, I love my family, and they were back east. So
Are they still, you
east.
Still got people?
Yeah. Yeah, I got great people back there. My one sister lives in Scituate, one yeah. sister lives in Revere, my brother lives in Washington. And I would like to say, though, that what I liked about doing this movie was just the first time I felt this in many years. I got to that family feeling.
Oh,
like,
yeah?
You know when you do a play in yeah. college or whatever? Yeah.
You mean with the people you were working with?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it was
sure.
great. We all pulled together. And,
well, I mean, I wanted, like, you know, I'm certainly, I just was trying to, like, because you mentioned Back to School, you were in that, and, you know, and I you know, you've done, you sort of show up in the Farrelly Brothers yeah, movies yeah. that you're sort of around, and then you, didn't you have a gig where, you know, didn't you get a show for a little while, like a sitcom?
I did. I had a sitcom in Boston, and I was on that show, Alf, out here. I did a lot of these
yeah,
little...
Yeah, right. And
that
like,
guy was insane.
Which guy?
The guy, Alf. You know that show, Alf?
Yeah.
That guy was crazy, man.
The guy who created it or the guy who did Alf? The
he
puppeteer?
Did it. He did it.
Yeah.
And Andy created it, and he'd be underneath the desk and, oh, look at me. And I'd say,
yeah.
Wow, this guy's got issues.
Yeah, but he
then, I wrote and I acted in a George Carlin's thing, and I got to know him. It
yeah.
was a sitcom and that went to HBO.
What was that called?
I forget what it was called because they didn't pick it up. It was a pilot, which was weird, you know, George Carlin, but I got to be around him.
Oh, yeah? How was that for you?
One of the most brilliant minds I've ever met in my life. We were in Portland, Mass.
Yeah.
Maine. Portland, Maine, excuse yeah. me, and we were driving back, and he named all the constellations. I said, wow, look, what a mind. You know?
Oh, he was like meticulous, curiosity. Real anal dude. Like he had all the jokes on note cards. There was no riffing, you know, it was all fucking...
In his office in yeah. Westwood, he'd have all his albums stacked up and books. I didn't, you know, he was just very nice to me. He was good. I saw his later specials and I saw him on Bill Maher.
Yeah.
Seemed like a different guy to me.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, well, you know, when that, I think that when guys start to really, especially guys who are prolific and guys who were, you know, fighting the power, punching up, you know, it starts to get dark. You know what I mean? I don't think anything happened to Carlin other than he got old and he got more cynical, and they, you know, it makes sense.
Yeah.
How else was he going to go?
Yeah, that's a good point. In other words, you've been doing it your whole life and you're still talking about the same stuff.
Yeah, and it gets and certain things aren't resolved and certain things are getting worse. And for a guy like him who's pointing out the hypocrisies, you know, it you know, you're going to get overwhelmed eventually and just be like, fuck it all.
Yeah.
Fuck it.
Yeah. But what I liked about George was he took shots at both sides,
yeah.
you know, and he went after political correctness, which I think
sure.
is fantastic, you know.
Sure, because you got to get the balance. Got to figure
you know,
out the
this,
balance.
This creative power, man, that goes through all of us. You can't try to tame it and say you can say this, you can't say that.
Well, it's all up to you. I mean, there's no law that says you can't. You just got to make sure you got to figure out where it's coming from and whether or not, you know, you're okay with that. It's really still on you.
But do you feel, I don't feel I'm in control of that. When I'm really in touch with something, things come out of me like in one 2 minute, like I used to do
right.
this bit Beaver and all this bullshit. And,
yeah.
And it all came in once.
What Beaver?
Oh, I had this bit about Leave It to Beaver, but it all came like in a flash.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
So that creative energy, you have to turn off me anyway.
Yeah.
To turn off the editor.
Yeah.
You know?
Well,
and
yeah.
Especially when you're on stage. I've had stuff get away from me that I do regret.
Yeah.
You know, when I said certain things
yeah.
on stage, but... You know, you look at a guy like Michael Richard. Is that who played
Michael
Kramer?
Richards, yeah.
So he leaves a sitcom. Then he goes on stage.
Yeah.
And he doesn't realize it's like a war out there sometimes. Somebody heckles him. He just says whatever comes up. Now he's, you know, life
pariah.
Life sentence, yeah.
Well, I mean, I don't know. Like, you know, it wasn't that, yeah, he was on a sitcom, but it wasn't like he was coming back to the stand-up stage. I don't know that he was ever really his racket, really.
Right.
And, you know, and it got away from him. Yeah, sure.
He's a brilliant physical actor.
Oh, no, funny as hell.
Yeah.
But I mean, I think that I don't think that, you know, there are those moments that, you know, you make mistakes, but I think it's the committing to the mistake and then defending it. Like, I think it's more about, like, you know, am I correct in where it's coming from in my heart? Like, right. Do I feel all right with that? And if you can answer that with a yes, then you shouldn't have any problem defending yourself. But if it's dubious, you should figure out why for yourself and then decide whether it's worth it.
Wow. That's pretty good.
You know what I mean? Yeah, I mean, it's like, you know, is it that hard?
Why don't you write that down? That was pretty good.
Well, you know, I think about it all the time because there are fights to be fought, but some of them are you know, are they really worth the fight? You know, is it so essential to your bit that you say fag that, you know, you're going to go to the mats for that? Do you know what I mean?
I do, but you know what?
That's just an example.
I wasn't pointing at a specific bit. Right, but, you know, it's like, with me, I don't purposely offend people. The object is not to offend people. And some of it, if it's offensive, that's on you. I mean, to me...
That's true.
To me, it's all on them because I'm an actor. I do different races, different dialects.
Yeah, I get that.
So does that make it racist? Well, if you think that, that's on you because it's not.
You know? That's not your intention.
And if there's any kind of objective... you know, criticism, then it's not. Anyway.
I understand what you're saying. But yeah, Carlin definitely took shots at both sides. It must have been an honor to spend time with him.
It was unbelievable. But I did this movie with Denzel.
Yeah.
And then I was working with Christopher Plummer. And I was just pinching myself. I was saying, let me get this straight. I'm doing a scene with Denzel Washington.
I know.
And then this other thing is, hey, he's... Would you frickin' say your lines? Yeah, do your job.
Because you're looking at him.
Do your job. Yeah. It's like going one-on-one with Michael Jordan. You say, I can't believe that I have this extraordinary experience to do this.
Yeah.
You know, it's a career that you just find yourself like meeting these people, and it's like, wow, how the heck did I get here?
You don't know what the fuck's going to happen. So like getting up to, you know, building back up to the movie, so you go back to Boston after Los Angeles. You're still in the game. Who's managing you? Mike?
No manager.
Ever?
No, I had a couple. I had Ted Curland, who managed Pat Metheny. He was a good guy. And then, you know, you don't need a manager. You don't need it. What is there to manage when you're in Boston? You know what I mean?
Well, that's the question. So how do you stay in the game?
Well,
back then, essentially.
Well,
right?
You know, the funny thing is, and this is how the universe works.
Yeah.
So I'm out here. I'm doing this. I'm doing that. And giving my power away to the big powers,
yeah,
whoever they are, and just trying to win the lottery out here,
yeah,
chasing ghosts. I come back, and all these movies are starting to be made in Boston. I get a movie with Peter Falk.
Yeah.
I get another movie with Jim Carrey, Danny Aykroyd, and all these guys.
Yeah.
And one thing after another, just getting cast because
right,
directors like me because I go in and I make my audition an event.
Yeah.
Like, it's not this polite thing, thank you very much. I try to do something that's memorable,
yeah,
and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. But I show them a range of things and they all want me on the set.
Right.
So if there's a part that fits, but like every actor, of course, 95% of the time you strike out. But that doesn't mean anything, you know, because I've cast movies.
Yeah.
And if you're not right, you're not right.
Right. Now, did you have a relationship with Rodney?
Yeah.
You did?
Yeah. I met Rodney at Caesars, and he had been up for a day or whatever, and he was involved in the same junk that we were all
with. Of course.
And I went up to his room at Caesars Palace. He had this table, and I swear to God, Mark, I had never seen so much Chinese food on one table, and that was just for him.
Yeah.
And he was in his bathrobe. And then we were down there, and then I went to a commercial. Remember those Budweiser commercials he did?
Yeah.
And Friedberg was one of them was directing it, and so I was, and then I saw him again, and he was what I used to say about Rodney to myself was he was a good guy, but he wasn't a happy guy.
For sure.
Whereas Carlin was, he was pretty happy.
Yeah, Richard Lewis said, Rodney used to call it the heaviness. He had the heaviness, the depression.
Yeah.
The heaviness.
He was, when I knew him, he met this woman down in on Malibu Beach, on one of these beaches, and she didn't know who he was, and he thought, that was really great. This woman doesn't know who I am. But at the time, he was like one of the most famous people. He was unmistakable.
Yeah.
So even when we did our little scene, which we shot at USC, this guy, you know, this homeless guy, he said, hey, Rodney, I don't get any respect either. I mean, everybody knew him. It was cool.
The funny thing and sad thing about Rodney is that, you know, after all is said and done, posthumously, he actually does not get the respect he deserves. He doesn't, you know what I mean? Like he, you know.
What's your favorite Rodney joke?
Oh, there's a few of them. I remember the first time I encountered Rodney Dangerfield was when I was a little kid, and they used to have the My Favorite Joke section at the back of Parade magazine.
Yeah.
It was that, like, I woke up and I went out to get out of the bedroom, and the doorknob came off. And then I went down and made some toast or something. The handle on the toaster came off. It just built up to him going, like, I'm afraid to go to the bathroom.
You know? I'm afraid to go to the bathroom. Yeah, he had the joke, and then he added the character and the physical. My favorite joke is, because it's the misdirection.
Yeah.
Your mind goes in one direction.
Right.
He says, I go to the dentist the other day for yellow teeth. He says, wear a brown tie. I love that joke.
Yeah, I love him. He was something else. So you stayed up in Boston, and then, so when, how does it look when you hit the wall with the shit?
Oh, you know, sick and tired of being sick and tired. You know, then I went on and saved my life. And then I changed, you know, from the inside out, and I appreciate everything that I have now, whereas before I had a lot and I didn't appreciate any of it.
Sure.
You know, so.
Were you teaching at Harvard?
No, I taught at Suffolk, and I taught at UMass. I taught at Quincy College.
Acting?
I taught acting and writing, and I liked it a lot. Right now, though, I'm more into producing my own stuff because this John Katz did this years ago. You did your own thing.
Yeah.
And Pete Fairley, of all people, he came to the opening of the movie, and he said, this is the way to do it.
Yeah.
He said, you know, you got to just do your own thing.
He just did the Green...
He's an incredible guy. I can't thank him
enough. Green Book, right?
Yeah, Green Book. He wrote the screenplay, and he won Best Picture, and he directed it.
What's his brother
doing? Peter and Bobby. Bobby's doing other similar things like that.
Uh-huh. Are they Boston guys?
They're Rhode Island guys.
Yeah.
Beautiful guys, you know? So, we only have so much time on this earth.
Yeah.
So I spend my time with people I like.
That's nice. So what's the...
I had to learn that in therapy. My therapist said, do you know that you don't have to be with people you don't want to be? And I said, really?
Yeah.
He said, yeah.
Then you got to be careful just not to be by yourself. Because I have that thing where it's sort of like, yeah, okay, I don't want to hang out with certain, you know, people I don't want to hang out with, but then it's like, oh,
do you find now that you're famous, which you are?
It's manageable, though.
What?
I have a manageable
fame. But I mean, I come up to your house.
Yeah.
And I say, this is great.
Well, I got no wife. I got no kids. I got no debt. You know, I'm saving money. I don't know what for.
You got high bushes. And it's kind of beautiful.
Thanks. This is all new to me, you know, but because I can't take it with me. So I had to figure out, like, you know, because I have a comic's brain. It's sort of like, I'm not going to spend any fucking money. I don't know when that money's going to go away.
That's good.
Yeah.
That's good to think that way.
Well, I still do. But then I was sort of like, well, I got to enjoy myself. Why not? Like, I've earned something. Maybe this idea of buying a new place is a nice thing to do for oneself.
I went to Steven Tyler's house. And, you know, we know each other because of Boston. And, you know, he's a great guy.
Is he out here?
No, this was when he was in Marshfield, Mass. But he had the high hedges and the whole thing.
Right.
And I said, that's nice. You come home and you're at peace, you know?
Yeah.
That's a nice thing.
Did he say he was?
You know, what we're all driven.
Yeah.
I mean, sure. if your idea of peace is like... And I get it why people want to do this, is to retire, for example.
Right.
So work is not part of peace. For me, it's a process. I got to have meaningful work.
So what is the, now let's talk about the two things. The one-man show is called what?
Townie. It's about growing up in Charlestown. And I'm going to shoot that in September. And the other thing I'm really proud of is called Sweeney Killing Sweeney. I play six characters, and I have all of these incredible comedians and a great director, Lisa.
But these
Mola.
Are characters that you've done in your act.
Yeah, so what happens is HBO comes to town. They said, we want you. Get rid of the characters. They're too local.
They want to do a special.
Yeah, so then the characters decide to try to kill me. So they come after me.
Right.
And I get to work with all of these great guys, you know, Lenny and, as I said, Frank Santarelli, Tony V, and Stephen Wright, and John Katz, Bobby Slayton, Nick DiPaolo,
I've interviewed all those guys.
Yeah.
I've literally interviewed all of those guys.
Yeah. I mean, check the movie out. You'll really like it.
Well, I think it's sort of like when I read the description and I saw the trailer, it's like, you know, this is, it seems to me that this is, you know, actually, when I see you with Tony V in that car and he's going, you got to lose the characters. Like that this is how's he doing, all right?
Tony's doing great.
Great. Yeah. Is this a real conversation you've had? Like, you know, there has been this struggle in your life that, you know, there was a sort of like the regionality, the regional nature of your act, which has been your bread and butter for your entire career, on some level does hold you back, you know.
Bill Broadus wrote this script.
I started with Broadus.
Yeah, great guy.
Yeah.
And he wrote this script. But that was the truth for me. But then I chose life over a career.
Right.
So nothing's actually holding me back, because what is it holding me back from? But also, when I go other places, people ask me the stupidest questions. Mm. Like they say, when you go to Las Vegas, do you do Boston jokes? I said, yeah, I'm a real idiot. I refer to Boylston Street. What are you, out of your freaking mind?
Sure.
What do you think, I'm that stupid?
Right.
Like when I did the improv out here, I came out on stage and I said, this is amazing, Los Angeles. It reminds me of the National Park, all these people camping out and on the street. And I said, guy said, you want some, do you have any change? I said, no, what you want is marshmallows. You want to cook out.
Right.
And then I said, I was up in San Francisco and I did all the touristy things, but then I wanted to be like a native. So I took a shit in the street and the people loved it, you know?
Right.
So a local is just a reference.
And you can riff.
Yeah, you can riff. Of course you can.
But
funny,
like,
is funny.
Yeah.
Know?
And how do you, like, without spoiling it, I mean, like you say in your life, you've chosen life. So you have some resolution, but I mean, it seems like there's a deeper meaning, and that Broadus knows you well enough.
Yeah.
To know that, you know, to be haunted by characters is one thing, but to actually be physically pursued by them is another. But is there some sort of cathartic conclusion to the end?
Yeah, it has a trick ending.
Oh, good.
There's two different endings.
Yeah.
There's a part of me, you know, it's funny you talk about this, because I've always seen things through. So you have this societal pressure that says success equals rich and famous.
Right.
So I never questioned why I left. Like, I knew it was the right thing for me.
Left
LA.
Here, sure, yeah. Well, I left once, too. I didn't want to come back.
But now,
yeah.
When people are opening doors, of course, it's a different place.
This is a shitty, horrible place when you got nothing to do, pal.
Absolutely.
It's the fucking worst. And I've been here for that. I've been back and forth several times. Like, there are different points in my career where, when I lived out here back in the day when I was a doorman at the store, I left with cocaine psychosis. I went back to Boston. I figured it out. I did 6 months of opening for Frank Santos, and I learned the, you know, I figured, you know, I got back to it. I went back to the trenches. I come back years later, get a divorce, things crap out, I'm back in New York. Like, I've had that relationship with this city. But
with the business.
Oh, yeah, dude.
Yeah.
And then the irony of it is like, my biggest success happens on my own, by my own will, in my own fucking garage.
I know.
And that changes
the whole
game.
I remember reading about it. I read about it, I think, in the Times and all this.
Right, the New York Times piece. That changed it, yeah.
Mark Maron's doing this thing out of his garage, and I always said, good for him.
Yeah.
You know, that's great.
Good.
Yeah, you probably had to clean the garage.
I didn't. I did eventually. But no, that's a funny thing. I don't think anyone's like, it's not like I didn't pay my fucking dues. It's not like anything was handed to me. It's good to be, you know, to find success later in life, because there's not a lot of assholes could go like, that fucking guy cheated. He skipped his turn.
But did you ever feel like you were paying? I never felt like I was paying dues. I never felt like I was I was 30 years old. I was making $40, $140 something a week, living in a loft in the South End, but I was acting. And I never felt like I was suffering. I never felt like I was paying dues. I enjoy the work.
No, I just felt like I wasn't good enough. I didn't feel like there was some conclusion to it. Obviously, yeah. I wanted to be a great comic.
Yeah.
But you know, when I look back on, you know, my time in Boston and doing all those one-nighters with you guys, you know, going to fucking Worcester, to Leominster, to Cranston, yeah. to yeah. Taunton, to fucking Johnny Yee's.
Hyannis, Johnny Yee's.
Yeah, all over the place. So, like, there was... I don't really, looking back on it, I don't know how the hell I did that, because they weren't easy things to do.
No.
And I was, you know, a very specific type of guy. But for some reason, your generation, you dealt with me. You know, there's other guys in my generation that you didn't deal with. But for some reason, I was wrapped up enough and you guys were okay with me somehow. And that,
you know what? We're good guys. We're just regular guys.
Oh, I know. But like, I wasn't, I wasn't a Boston guy. But
no,
I always appreciated the fact that I could do it. But I don't know how the fuck I did it. So when I say I paid my dues, I'm like, if you ask me, like, what was that like? I'm like, it was fucking hell, man. It was warfare for me to figure out how to talk to a room, me, Mark Maron at age 21, this angry kind of existential, you know, heady fucking Jewish guy, you know, is standing like, I remember one time going on after Leary at Nick's, and Dennis, whether he did well or not, he was going to rip the room apart. You know what I mean? It was just, and I got up there, I'm like, I'll just jump into his energy. And I got up there and I did 7 minutes and I tanked so hard.
I know.
The vacuum of it.
But
what I'm saying is, like, I don't regret any of that.
Right.
But I definitely
I had to do the same thing.
Of course.
When I was paying dues, whether you
like it or not.
Right. When I was doing plays,
there
was a backstage, okay? There was a place where you prepared. You work in these shitholes always named after the guy, you know, Vinny's fucking dump hole. There's no place that you just, it's like fucking, it's just right. And I had to learn how to do that. And then when you work in a theater and you're saying to yourself, shit, they're listening to me.
It's great.
Then you have to work in the subtlety and not go for the immediate laugh.
I think I say that because I'm proud of it, because like, I didn't come up, like, I'm not an alternative comic or whatever. Like, I came up the old way.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and
you paid those emotional dues.
Oh, man.
It gives you something.
It does. I'm proud of it.
Whatever it is, it gives you something.
Yeah.
You know? And you know what happens to me is, like, I'm a very nice person now as far as like CVS's and drugstores and Starbucks.
Sure.
But I have this part of me that's like, anytime I want, I can take over this fucking room. And she gives me a hard time. I can make a speech.
Yeah, sure. You're a black belt and asshole.
Yeah, black. Very good. Absolutely. I know how to be an asshole.
Yeah. I know.
But you try not to bring it out.
Well, you don't want to use it. It's illegal to use it.
But you know, the thing is, you get cranky when you get older. And there's certain things. Like, I grew up, you say, I say thank you, you say you're welcome. So I pull up to like a McDonald's, whatever, say, and I say thank you. And then they don't say anything.
Yeah.
So there, I'm giving a lecture to some 17-year-old kid. Now, when I say thank you say you're welcome. I'm saying, what am I doing? Spending my day giving lectures.
You're giving him a memorable experience.
This guy came. Or you say thank you, and they say no problem. And I say, I know there's not a problem. Why am I in this conversation with these idiots,
right.
You know?
Oh man,
it's funny.
So do you still have a club of your own?
No, I work at Giggles, Mike Clark's club
at the Leaning Tower of Pizza.
The Leaning Tower of Pizza.
That's still going, huh?
Oh yeah, it's a great room.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, and you know, I work various places back east, and I'm trying to get these movies off the ground. I got another one I wrote that we're pitching the Irish Film Board about my trips to Ireland.
What is that?
Well, I wrote a movie about my bike trips in Ireland, you know?
Uh-huh.
And it's about how people act like their nationalities. Like, I've done four of these bike trips. And
that's your thing, bikes?
The bike and hike, but the tour guide was always hungover. He was Irish.
Right.
The Americans were always enthusiastic. What are we going to do today?
Yeah.
And the Germans, very literal. You know, I'd say, they said to me, how was the town? I said, it was all right. So it was good? Well, it was all right. So it was bad, you know?
Yep. So I... no in between?
Yeah. So I got this, that going, and then I have another movie that I'm, I want to get off the ground, but want to see this one through. And yeah, that's my thing right now is just producing movies.
Well, you look great. You sound great. I'm very happy you're okay. It was a treat to see you and talk to you.
You know, Mark, I'm so proud of you, man, because it's like you did it your own way, number one. But also, you know, it is a crapshoot, isn't it? You just did something. You weren't expecting anything, and here you are.
You don't know, man. It's just like they, you know, you always hear that it's not a meritocracy, no shit. And the sad thing is about, you know, very talented people is that, you know, they might destroy themselves. It just might happen.
Yeah.
You know, people who are just kind of talented but very focused, they seem to manage somehow.
they know how to do life. Yeah.
Yeah, I did not.
But there's guitarists out there playing in little bars in Ohio.
That are geniuses.
Absolutely. There's guys in rep companies, theater guys, that they'll never get anywhere. And my brother's one of them. My brother's a brilliant actor. And they're out there, and they're just creating magic and mesmerizing. But
does your brother have peace in his life?
Oh, yeah. He's out of the business.
Okay.
So listen, the movie is on...
The courage of that man.
Yes, you better believe it. The movie's on iTunes called Sweeney Killing Sweeney. It's going to be on Amazon on Wednesday, and it's been a real treat. Thank you.
It's good talking to you, Steve.
All right, my man.
There you go. The legend, Steve Sweeney, Boston Zone. Yeah, it was that was something, man. It was wild, you know. There was parts of it that were just as intimidating as they were when I was, 25 or however old I was. Again, his movie, Sweeney Killing Sweeney, is available on iTunes and Amazon. He'll be at the Improv Asylum in Boston this Sunday, June 23rd, doing his one-man show, Townie. I have to go shoot some movie now. Oh, God, I'm exhausted. I haven't teed up for the day completely. Okay, bye. Boomer lives!